go there.
Good morning, sir.
Comment by the court that suggests the burden of proof was on the defendant, as you argue, really was a comment. As I read it, the court was seeking to advise the defendant that about the relative chances that he'd have 12 folks and only one. You know, he was speaking of unanimity that was required. And I understand the argument that it's, but it also seemed to misinform about the burden of proof. But would you agree that that was a statement made, it seemed, to be more in keeping with the concept of unanimity, which would have been, in theory, the defendant would need to think about that was a benefit to him.
That's true, Your Honor, that it would seem to be a statement telling that the jury must be unanimous. But trial court is going to do that, the trial court needs to tell them that the state has a burden of proving that each of those 12 jurors that Richard Dagan is guilty is not to be released.
Would the court's failure, if we read this as really a comment about the necessity that the jury be unanimous to convict, is the defendant also is there a separate argument about the burden of proof that the court didn't speak at all about the burden of proof? Did the court have to do that also?
No, the test here is the totality of the circumstances. And maybe the statement standing alone isn't enough to say that this waiver is invalid. It doesn't stand alone. It stands with, I don't know which way I want to go, really.
Yeah.
And at that point, the court did have a duty to advise them. It is true that Richard Bates said at first that my counsel failed to confess. And at that point, the court would rely on that statement until it heard otherwise. The court could have relied on my counsel's being confessed to say, well, counsel must have told him that the burden of proof was on the state jury. I think the court could have relied on that. Up until the point that Richard Bates said, I don't know which way I want to go, really. Evidently then the court was on notice that there was something wrong with Richard Bates' understanding of the right to the jury. And at that point, the court had a duty to correct that and explore what was meant by that statement.
Is there a waiver of the waiver issue?
No, Your Honor. This was brought up at the Court of Appeals, and it was ruled on the merits of the Court of Appeals. And the fact that there was no objection at the trial court level was not fatal to the claim.
In addition to there not being any objection, he fully participated. I mean, he was aware that he didn't have a jury. Why should we not think that that's some sort of a waiver? Well, he knew he wasn't being tried by the jury, and they went out with the trial anyway, with the three-judge panel.
Oh, yeah, but initially, Your Honor, he had the right to make a known decision whether or not to do so.
I understand.
The trial continued on with the jury or three-judge panel. The right existed. In the first.
Yeah, I understand. And to be sure of that, the judge had him sign a second waiver.
Yes.
Okay. And then he went on with the trial.
Crucially, Your Honor, the trial did not just go on. What did happen is that the prosecutor suggested immediately after that jury waiver was brought in, that immediately after it was signed in the courtroom, the prosecutor suggested keeping the jury around for a couple of hours to close the case of the difficulty. The trial court's suggestion as a way around that difficulty was for each side to temporarily waive opening arguments until the afternoon, and for a witness to be quickly sworn in, quote, so there will be no backing out of the witness, no waiver of the jury. And that's just wrong, Your Honor. That goes to the totality of the circumstances. And that shows that in that courtroom, everybody knew that waiver.
What is your citation to the record for that?
Transcript 7.
And the judge specifically said, as I recall reading the materials that I have, that what he was trying to do is vest very clearly in the three-judge panel jurisdiction.
Yes, he was. But it shows also that the judge had doubts about whether or not Richard Bates would change his mind. That he really knew what he was doing when he made that waiver.
If changing your mind is a defendant changing his mind as between the jury and the three-judge panel, does that necessarily suggest that it wasn't knowing and voluntary and intelligent? I'm wondering if that's a necessary corollary.
If he were to change his mind, then that would show necessarily that the waiver was not valid.
Well, I gather your point is if he changed, they were worried he might change his mind,
right.
That necessarily suggests that the waiver was not good. But one could still have, say it, with knowing voluntarily and intelligently, make that choice and still wish to change their mind, couldn't
right.
they?
Yeah. Right. The court, yes, the defendant could easily do that.
And that wouldn't be error, would it? I mean, that wouldn't violate the waiver. To later wish to change your mind doesn't tell us that we couldn't uphold that jury waiver.
No, the defendant has to change his mind.
Right, right. But I mean after.
After.
They were worried that he'd change his mind. Okay, I get it.
Sorry, I'm not mistaken about it. The trial court's duty here was to explore with Richard Bates that he was not going to have a statement that his waiver was, or that it was his right. The trial court's duty here was to explore with Richard Bates what he meant by the fact that he didn't know which way he wanted to go, really, and that he thought his tribunal would be unfair. The totality of the circumstances here indicates that this waiver wasn't valid. In closing, Blackstone called trial by jury the glory of English law. It is a right so precious that 70 years ago in patent in the U.S., the United States Supreme Court spoke to the question of whether jury duty would be waived. That court said in closing, while determining this could be waived, and the duty of the trial court in that regard is not to be discharged as a mere matter of rote, but with sound and advised discretion, and with a caution increasing in degree as the offense is dealt with increasing gravity. There is no case more grave than the capital one. In this case, the trial court failed in its duty to accept only constitutionally sound waiver, thus the conviction must be overturned and consummated by the trial. The police and court were equally competent in our second proposition of law. The trial court's duty to protect constitutional rights extends to hearing pretrial suppression motions. In this case, the court refused to reopen the question of whether Richard Bates' confession was voluntary. This decision defined Richard Bates as due process of law. Due process, in its simple and most elegant form, means simply that a defendant must have notice and an opportunity to be heard. The trial court's decision not to reopen Richard Bates' confession issue deprived him of an opportunity to be heard on the issue of whether his confession was voluntary, an issue central to this case. 7 days after the indictment, the defendant filed a motion to suppress the confession based on promises of leniency to Richard Bates by the police officer during the interrogation. On February 24, 1994, the court held a hearing, and after additional briefing, found that the statements were not found in the confession to commit. Defense counsel then proceeded with mitigation. Eventually, they learned that Bates had an IQ of 74, that he was substance addicted, and he had brain damage possibly from a birth injury. On November 28th, the case before trial, the court moved for continuance to reopen the hearing, reopen the issue of discussion, and the trial court denied that. The mental status of the accused is an important factor in determining whether a confession is voluntary. It is not disability alone to determine whether a confession is voluntary. Rather, the question is whether the police overreached or taken advantage of disability.
Did the detective lie to the defendant?
Yes, he did at one point in the confession. He knew exactly how he committed the crime. And he knew that.
Was that a lie?
They did not have all the details of the crime, and they did not have the court also for the defense of the detectives also told them that they would have blood evidence linking him to the crime, and there wasn't the blood evidence.
Was the detective telling him things that he had anticipated they would have?
I believe that was the detective that affirmed it.
Hadn't the detective talked to a witness and said that he saw red material on the shirt of the defendant?
The detective talked to the witness after that statement. The statement from...
Was it after the interrogation?
Yes, that was after the interrogation.
So if a detective in questioning the defendant stretches the truth or makes things up or lies during the interrogation, you feel that that is automatically an untrustworthy confession.
No, Your Honor, because the test of the totality of the circumstances, including any misrepresentation to the defendant.
I mean, if I'm talking to someone and they're telling me something that is not true, I can always just say, no, that's not true. I didn't do that, or I wasn't there, or I didn't say that. Can't they?
Yes, they can.
I mean, are you intimating that the detective led the defendant to indicate that that they knew exactly what happened and that he did it?
Yes, that is what Detective Savage did.
Saying that the detective at that time really didn't know what he was talking about.
No, I'm saying the detective at that time knew exactly what he was talking about. He was leading her today to believe that if he confessed, he would have leniency.
What I mean about the facts or how he did it, those were all lies because he really didn't know how the crime was committed.
No, he had some information at that point. He did have some information. He had the confidential informant's information that said that how the crime had been committed and where the evidence was.
And that information was quite accurate, was it not?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. But the detective also told him that they had blood evidence linking him to it, and they did not during that 12-minute unpaid interval. And we can't be exactly sure what went on in that 12 minutes because it was unpaid. And that is what called into question all the voluntariness of this confession. Because there was no answer granted, because the suppression motion issue was not renewed, there is no answer in the record as to whether the police overreached during that 12 minutes and took advantage of Bates' ability to surrender the confession involuntary. It is the state's burden to prove a confession voluntary. In this case, the court's decision not to reopen the issue relieved the state of that burden of proof and denied the defendant in the process of law. In closing, Your Honors, a trial court must do more than just leave the proceedings along as happened in this case. He or she must act with fair regard for the rights of both the state and the defendant. Here, the trial court disregarded the rights of the defendant by accepting an invalid waiver and by not reopening the suppression issue. For these reasons, this case must be reversed and the prosecution is from the trial.
Thank you, Mr. Reed. The will have not filed a brief and therefore not entitled to oral arguments. The case is submitted. We'll see you by the